Is London calling North America? Next in our program, we present two dispatches by Jack Kelly.
WHO. This is your war correspondent, Jack Shelley, speaking to you from somewhere in Holland. Once again, this report is being relayed to you through an Army mobile transmitter and the British Broadcasting Corporation. One of the most courageous fights in the series of bitter struggles to hold the great German counteroffensive in check, and one of the first to climax with a heavy defeat for an important part of the enemy forces, was fought out over the Christmas holiday weekend at a point around the northern flank of the Nazi penetration. You've heard how one of the best panzer divisions in the German army was caught in a Yankee trap and cut to pieces, with almost 140 of their vehicles captured by the Americans, including 39 tanks, most of them in good condition. I was in the town where the battle roared to its climax just the morning after the Germans were cleared out. Some of the shattered buildings of the town were still burning as I talked to officers and men who had taken part in the fight. It was Christmas Day when I entered the town, and the fighting men were having their turkey dinner. The colonel commanding this particular regiment had given strict instructions that every man in the outfit have a chance to eat a real honest-to-goodness Christmas dinner, and they did have. I sat down at the table with one battalion commander and sampled the turkey myself while he was our drumstick. "Not far," he said.
"The colonel hails from South Carolina."
"Yes, sir. We had our Thanksgiving spoiled because we were in a fight. But by golly, we took care to get this battle over in time for Christmas dinner." It had been a hard and savage fight, with the margin between defeat and victory extremely close for a while. The regiment had moved up at night in a race to get in front of the onrushing tanks of the Nazi division, spearheading the great enemy offensive. "He sort of dumped us out," the colonel said, "and told us the Jerrys are coming down the road. Go get them." They did get them, but not until after a savage Nazi attack drove our forces back within 800 yards of the regimental command post. And in various phases of the action, more than 100 yards, including the commander of the 3rd Battalion, were captured. These Americans were all in the when our forces turned the tide and captured the town, where they were being kept under German guard. Officers of the regiment gave a great deal of credit to a hastily summoned 3rd Battalion, which arrived on the scene in time to match up much of the German armor. And this was the first battle these American tank men had taken part in since they landed in war, but they conducted themselves like veterans. It was almost like a movie plot, one officer told me. If our tanks had arrived an hour later, we'd never been able to stop the Germans and then go on to cut them up. Moreover, the whole Nazi counteroffensive might have been greatly advanced. This was one of the most important spearheads, and it was time to head northwest. But the real answer to why the Jerrys were stopped and then destroyed in this battle lay as it always does. The American soldier. And perhaps the outstanding demonstration of that was by Sergeant William Wagner of Logansport, Indiana, and the small group of men under his command. Wagner and about 10 other men were held in the barn when a swarm of Germans shouting Heil Hitler and charging fanatically began to attack their position. From 6 o'clock in the evening, all night, and until late the next afternoon, just about 24 hours, Sergeant Wagner and his small band hurled back one Nazi attack after another. All through the night, the Germans hurled hand grenades into the barn. But we grabbed them before they went off, the sergeant said, and threw them right back. The courage and devotion to duty of the sergeant's men were beyond any words to describe. One of the Yanks was wounded severely in the left hand early in the battle. And since he was left-handed, he couldn't handle his rifle. But he crawled his way back to the command post, where an officer assumed the wounded man was ready to be evacuated for treatment. "No," the boy shouted. "Wagner needs me out there. All I want is some more ammunition." And despite the condition of his hand, he carried some ammunition back himself and gathered two other men back with additional supplies. Then, using his right hand, he seized a pistol and kept on helping beat off the German attack. He was wounded twice more, once in the face and once in the shoulder, before he finally consented to being removed to an aid station. Another American soldier was holding a machine gun post in a foxhole near the barn when the Germans made their first command attack, yelling and screaming.
Armour found him later, dead but still leaning forward. He had fired his machine gun, mowing down Germans, until some of them broke through right on top of him. Then he had grabbed the revolver and fired four or five shots from it before he was killed. When his comrades found him, the gun was still hotly tensed in his right arm. Sergeant Wagner directed the fight for 24 hours, but finally his superiors ordered him to evacuate later in the afternoon the following day. The next day, the Yanks assaulted the place in force and took it for good. And in 10 months, Wagner lost four casualties, two killed and two wounded. After the wounded men were so badly hurt they could no longer hold any kind of weapon, they managed to get a phone to their ears and relayed orders and reports between the battle town building and the command post farther back. Sergeant Wagner has already been recommended for the Purple Star decoration for heroism in one earlier action. He almost certainly will get another medal for this one. But he's not impressed about what he and his mom do. We just saw him coming, the sergeant says, and we decided we'd make a fight out of it. That's the kind of men you've worked back on who will stop this German offensive for you. This is Jack Kelly, speaking from somewhere in Holland. I return you to the mob.
This is the first dispatch by Jack Kelly at the station WHO Des Moines. The second dispatch follows in 10 seconds time.
Hello, WHO. This is your war correspondent, Jack Kelly, speaking to you from somewhere in Holland. This broadcast is being relayed to you through an Army mobile transmitter and the British Broadcasting Corporation. This has been a strange holiday season up here in the forward area of the Western European front. Over everything has hung the atmosphere of war, closer than it's been for weeks. Even in the cities considerably behind the line, where the footless observance is carried out as nearly as possible like it would be in normal times, there's been no escaping the constant reminder that the most savage and perhaps the most decisive battle of the war is the part of the most in a certain Dutch town behind the front, that all-pervading atmosphere touched everything that people did. I went to a Red Cross club that night to watch enlisted men of the American Army being entertained with a special party. The Dutch people of the town had arranged a home talent show for the men, and afterward there was dancing with Dutch girls as partners for our GIs. By the way, one of the sights you don't soon forget is that of a young woman of Holland solemnly following a Yankee soldier through the convolutions of a jitterbug dance routine. Whether you think it's one of our finer accomplishments or not, the fact is the jitterbug dance is being brought to Europe wherever our men go in the liberated countries. In another part of the building, an endless line of GIs move slowly into the kitchen, getting cocoa and wrapping themselves in huge mounds of cookies and cakes. They came out into the parlor, and soon somebody had organized a song fest. And we sang the songs we've always sung on Christmas Eve at home. Silent Night, Adeste Fidelis, Our Little Town of Bethlehem, and all the rest. And I don't think there was an American there in that room in a Red Cross club in Holland who didn't feel the melancholy of Christmas far from home, and who didn't think of his loved ones across the sea. But then it was time to go, and the GIs picked up their rifles again and clapped on their steel helmets and said Merry Christmas to their Dutch hosts and the Red Cross girls, and went out into the moonlit night. Then somebody asked if some of the correspondents wanted to go to a midnight service at a nearby church. And we found the congregation made up almost entirely of American servicemen and women. As I said, it was a moonlit night, a good night for German planes. And as the service progressed, we heard the sound of sirens outside, and then anti-aircraft guns firing, and finally the rumble of a bomb somewhere in the distance. The congregation didn't make a move. The priest didn't waver a note in his chest. The sound of the guns came to an end. The Dutch priest spoke briefly in English to his American congregation. In this holy, yet not silent night, he told them, I know there must be sorrow in your hearts at being away from home on Christmas Eve. But he told them nothing could ever take the Christmas spirit away from men of goodwill, that if all such men do their duty, they will have won a priceless possession for themselves and for all free men. And he told them, with a sincerity that impressed every one of his listeners,
that he prays that next Christmas they could all be back with their families and their loved ones again. The next day, Christmas Day, I went into a front-line town from which the Germans had been cleared out only the previous afternoon. Shattered buildings were still on fire. Captured German tanks stood in the streets. Beside the road, Americans were still picking up the bodies of dead Germans for burial. And on the side of the ruined building, there hung a crudely lettered sign scrawled in rough paint. Merry Christmas to all the battalions, and a Happy New Year. In the yard stood a battered Christmas tree, hung with a few crudely made ornaments. That was Christmas at the front. And a few yards away, our guns were hammering, while overhead, American planes placed cannons and white vapor trails as they roared over the band of German tanks and troops in the Nazi spearhead. Yes, the holy season is strange one in the World War, but there's never been a time when men were, or should be, more aware of the sacrifices that others are making, that they might be free. And in the Holocaust of battle, men learned more truly than ever before, that as the Dutch clergyman said, while the sound of guns died away, nothing can ever take the Christmas spirit away from men of goodwill. This is Jack Kelly, speaking from somewhere in Holland. I return you to Des Moines.
This is the British Broadcasting Corporation.